Imagine like spending 10 years and just millions of dollars building this massive state-of-the-art skyscraper.
Oh, yeah. You pour the foundation, put up the steel skeleton.
Right, the whole city is buzzing about it. And then suddenly, because one specific architect passes away, the entire site is just abandoned to the
It's just
elements.
left there.
Yeah,
Yeah.
for almost a decade. I mean, that would never happen in real estate. It rarely even happens in Hollywood, you know?
No, in Hollywood, if a director or a writer drops out, the studio just hires like three more people to finish the script.
Exactly, they just keep shooting. But in the fragile, just incredibly delicate ecosystem of Broadway, that is exactly what happened to one of the most famous friendship stories of all time.
It is basically the absolute definition of development hell. But with a final act that literally nobody, probably not even the original creators, could have predicted when they started out.
Which brings us to exactly why we are here today. So, welcome to you, our dedicated listener, the learner, to this deep dive, because today's exploration is just uniquely, perfectly
It
timed.
really is.
Okay, let's unpack this. Today is Thursday, March 26, 2026.
Which is wild.
It is wild because that means exactly one day from now, tomorrow night, the highly anticipated Broadway previews finally begin at the Majestic Theater for a musical that has been trying to get to the Great White Way for 12 years. And that show is Beaches.
And we're going to use the show's Wikipedia page as our ultimate backstage pass to, map out this whole timeline.
Yeah.
Because looking at the sources, this isn't just some dry lesson in theater history or like a boring list of casting changes. It's this fascinating story about the winding, chaotic, and completely unpredictable path of long-term projects.
Definitely. Something you listening right now can probably relate to with your own passion projects. But before we can look at the construction site, we have to understand what it is they were actually trying to build, right?
Yeah.
We need to establish the core architecture of the story.
Right, the foundation. So this is based on a very famous piece of literature. The musical adapts Iris Rayner Dart's 1985 novel, Beaches. And the original book for the musical was actually co-written by Dart herself alongside Tom Thomas.
And whether you know the novel or, maybe the 1988 movie adaptation,
Well, the movie is iconic.
so iconic. Or even if you are coming to this completely fresh, the plot hinges entirely on one of the most famous friendships in modern fiction. It follows two lifelong friends and former pen pals, CeCe Bloom and Bertie White.
Yeah.
And I've always found their dynamic to be just the ultimate opposites attract trope. It's fire and ice.
Oh, they could not be more different. I mean,
Yeah.
C is this fiercely ambitious, street smart singer and actress from the Bronx.
Right.
She's loud, she's brassy, she just fundamentally takes up space wherever she goes.
She's the fire that constantly threatens to burn the house down, basically.
Yeah.
While Birdie is this waifish, incredibly book smart girl from San Francisco who eventually becomes a lawyer. She's reserved, she's cautious. She is the ice that keeps everything grounded and structured.
Which is perfectly mirrored in their backgrounds, too. Like, even their mothers reflect this dichotomy. And they're actually really crucial to the stage adaptation.
Oh, totally.
If you look at the character list, it includes Leona Bloom, who is C's just incredibly overbearing stage mother. She's constantly pushing her daughter into the spotlight, basically teaching her that love is transactional,
That it's all based on performance.
Exactly. And then on the other side, you have Rose White, Birdie's stuffy high society mother. For her, everything is about appearances, decorum, and just shrinking yourself to fit the mold.
And the title itself, Beaches, it's so literal, but also incredibly symbolic. Because these two girls from entirely different worlds, they first meet as children by chance on a beach in Atlantic City.
Right.
And then, much later in life, as adults dealing with the heavy, complicated realities of their lives, they spend time together at a beach cottage on the West Coast.
So the beaches are these like liminal spaces where they can strip away the armor their mothers gave them.
Yes. They can just be themselves. And aside from the mothers, there are a few other key players in their orbit, like John Perry, who is a shared love interest for both women, but eventually he marries CeCe.
And later on, we meet Michael Barron, a lawyer who becomes Bertie's husband. But the core, like the absolute beating heart of the narrative, is the decades-long bond between these two women.
Maintained for years, primarily through letters, which honestly brings up a massive logistical challenge that I really want to push on here.
Okay, go for it.
How do you translate a lifetime of letters and distant friendship into a compelling 2.5-hour live show?
You're tough.
I mean, reading letters in a novel allows you to imagine the passage of time, but watching two people stand on opposite sides of a stage writing letters sounds like a recipe for putting an audience to sleep.
Yeah, you lose that kinetic energy.
Exactly. Where is the kinetic energy?
Well, it's the central problem of adapting epistolary novels to the stage, right?
Mm.
But the answer here lies in the really unique structural and casting choices the creative team made.
Okay, how so?
So if you look closely at the character list on the Wikipedia page, you'll see a very specific pattern. They use dual and even triple casting for the leads.
Wait, triple?
Yeah. You don't just have an adult CC and an adult Birdie.
Yeah.
The cast list explicitly requires a little CC and little Birdie, as well as a teen CC and teen Birdie.
Oh, wow. So they aren't just doing quick costume changes to show aging. They are physically manifesting the passage of time with different bodies on stage.
Exactly. The musical uses this visual layering to span an entire lifetime right in front of the audience.
That's brilliant.
By having the younger versions of the characters present, sometimes even interacting or harmonizing with their adult counterparts, It visually anchors the complexities of their adult lives right in their childhood roots.
I see what you mean. Because it's one thing to hear an adult character say, like, oh, I miss how simple things used to be.
Right.
It is entirely different and frankly devastating to see a 40-year-old Birdie on stage singing a harmony with the 10-year-old version of herself.
It forces the audience to physically confront their own lost youth.
Wow, yeah. It solves the letter reading problem by making the passage of time a dynamic, living part of the emotional landscape.
It literally makes memory a physical character in the show.
Okay, so we have this beautiful, decade-spanning narrative about enduring friendship. That is the blueprint. Now, let's look at the actual construction site. Because the timeline of getting this show on its feet is incredibly prolonged and, honestly, quite painful.
Yeah, it really is.
According to the Wikipedia timeline, the world premiere of Beaches the Musical actually took place over a decade ago. It opened at the Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia, running from February to March of 2014.
Directed by Eric T. Schaefer, with music by David Austin.
Right. And it had real momentum. The Virginia run was successful enough that the show packed up and moved to the Drury Lane Oak Brook Theater in Chicago the very next summer in 2015.
Which is the classic out-of-town tryout path for a Broadway-bound show, you know?
Yeah, you test it in the D.C. area, refine it in Chicago, and then you just march into New York. It was on the conveyor belt.
The machinery of commercial theater was working exactly as intended.
But then the timeline just flatlines. The entry notes this devastating halt. Co-book writer Tom Thomas died in December 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, progress on the show completely freezes for nearly 10 years. Now, I have to challenge this timeline a bit.
Okay.
I hear you on the tragedy of losing a creator, but we're talking about a multi-million dollar commercial property here. A successful Chicago run usually means the investors are lined up, the Broadway theaters are being scouted.
Right.
Is it really normal for an entire production to just freeze for a decade because one writer passes away? I mean, like I said earlier, in Hollywood, they just buy the rights and hire a new writer to finish the script.
All right.
What was actually happening behind the scenes that kept this locked up for almost a decade?
Well, it's a completely fair question, because from a purely corporate standpoint, it really doesn't make sense.
Right.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture of how theatrical development actually works, we see a massive difference between a Hollywood film studio and a Broadway musical. First, just to be clear, for anyone who isn't a massive theater nerd, the book isn't the novel the show is based on. It's the spoken dialogue and the narrative structure between the songs.
Oh, right.
So the book writer is essentially the architect of the story.
They dictate the pacing, how a scene builds to the emotional breaking point where a character has no choice but to start singing.
Precisely. A musical is a delicate living ecosystem of very specific creative minds.
Yeah.
The book writer, the lyricist, the composer, the director, they are locked in this incredibly intimate symbiotic relationship. The book writer, in this case Tom Thomas, alongside Iris Rayner Dart, dictates the very DNA of the show. So losing him wasn't just losing a contractor, he was losing a foundational pillar.
It's like pulling a load-bearing wall out of a house right before you put the roof on. You can't just plug a new writer in and say, hey, match his voice.
You really can't.
Yeah.
And legally, the rights of theatrical estates are incredibly complex. When a co-creator dies, their estate often has a say in how the property moves forward.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah. But beyond the legalities, when you are dealing with a deeply personal story about grief, loss, and the passage of time, which is exactly what's going. Beaches is the real-world grief of losing your co-creator. Essentially, paralyzed the project.
Hmm.
The ecosystem was shattered. It had to heal, and that process took 9 years.
So the ecosystem is shattered in 2015. How do you even begin to pick up the pieces of a show like that?
Well, the answer is you don't. At least not until 2024.
Right. The story jumps forward to a massive creative resurrection at Theatre Calgary in Canada, running in May and June of 2024.
And is not the same show that played in Chicago.
No.
This time, it's co-directed by Lonnie Price and Matt Coward, and it undergoes a massive creative overhaul.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because they didn't just dust off the 2015 script and recast the actors. Iris Rainerdart completely revised the book.
Mm-hmm.
And even more drastically, the show got entirely new music. They brought in the legendary Mike Stoller to write a brand new score with new orchestrations by Charlie Rosen. They completely scrapped the 2014 David Austin score.
Completely threw it.
Yeah. So to go back to our earlier metaphor, this isn't just a fresh coat of paint. This is taking a classic car that's been sitting in a garage under a tarp for 10 years, pulling it out, and completely swapping out the engine with a brand new one.
And changing the composer in a musical fundamentally alters the physics of the show.
Definitely.
Music is the emotional engine. Now, Mike Stoller's historical influence on music is monumental. I mean, he is the man behind Hound Dog, Stand By Me, and just massive hits of the 1950s and 60s.
A legend.
So he brings an entirely different harmonic language, a blues and R&B infused rhythm to the piece.
So the actual auditory landscape of the show shifts completely. It probably feels a lot more grounded in the mid-century era, as when C and Birdie are actually growing up.
Exactly. And Charlie Rosen's orchestrations give that vintage musical vocabulary a completely fresh theatrical texture.
Let's actually look at the track list from that 2024 Canadian revival, because Wikipedia provides the breakdown of Act 1 and Act 2, and it is so revealing about how this new engine actually runs.
Yeah, let's look at it.
For example, there's a song called Wish I Could Be Like You.
Yes, and notice how it's deployed. It's not just sung once. It's introduced by Little CC and Little Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
Then it gets a reprise by the adult CC and Birdie. And then a third reprise sung by just CC.
It's the connective tissue. It goes back to what we were saying about how they physically handle the passage of time. You literally hear the evolution of their jealousy, their admiration, and their love for each other maturing through the different iterations of that one song.
It tracks the psychological growth of the characters.
We also see songs that highlight their physical and emotional differences, like Size D Letters, sung by both women.
Right, which clearly plays on the epistolary nature of their friendship, the letters they write, while likely leaning into the comedic contrast between their lives, their experiences, and their bodies.
But there is one track in Act that really made me stop and look twice. The song is called God Bless Girlfriends.
Oh, yeah.
It's a title that just screams female empowerment anthem. You immediately picture C, C, and Birdie center stage belting it out. But look at who sings it. The track list attributes it to John Perry and Michael Barron.
The men in their lives.
The men.
It is a fascinating subversion. When you think about a story titled Beaches that centers almost exclusively on two women, you totally expect the big friendship anthems to be delivered by them.
Of course.
But having the male character sing God Bless Girlfriends is a brilliant structural choice.
I agree, but I also think it's risky. Doesn't it take the spotlight off the women in their own show?
It could, if done poorly. But what it actually does is use the male perspective, the outside perspective, to frame and elevate the central female friendship.
Oh, I see.
It's the men acknowledging that no matter how important they are as husbands or lovers, the bond between these two women is a force of nature that they can really only stand back and revere. It defines the hierarchy of the show. You know, the friendship comes first, the romances are secondary.
I love that. It takes what could be a generic upbeat song and turns it into a real narrative tool. Okay, so this 2024 Calgary run with the Solar score clearly works because that bridges us directly to the present day. Tomorrow, March 27, 2026.
The final destination.
The show is taking over the Majestic Theater. Opening night is set for April 22, and it will run a limited engagement through September 6 before heading out on a national tour.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'm looking at the Wikipedia pages table for the casts across all these different years, there is something incredibly weird going on.
What's that?
Well, over the years, the role of CC Bloom has been played by some absolute powerhouse vocalists. Alicia Umfriss in Virginia, Shoshana Bean in Chicago, Jessica Vosk in Calgary.
An incredible lineage of belters.
Seriously. But for the 2026 Broadway column, the leads for C, C, Birdie, and John are left entirely blank.
Just empty boxes.
Yes. Yet the table explicitly lists the supporting roles. Like, Ben Jacoby is locked in as Michael Barron, and Sarah Bockel is listed as Leona Bloom. Is this some closely guarded theatrical secret? Are the Wikipedia editors just furiously hitting refresh on Broadway press releases right now, sweating at their keyboards?
Probably.
Because tomorrow is the first preview. How can Wikipedia not know who is playing CC on Broadway?
It is almost certainly the latter. It's just a quirk of how crowdsourced encyclopedias work in real time.
Right.
Wikipedia relies on published, verified press releases to update its tables. So it's highly probable that the producers have been very strategic with their press rollouts.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in the chaotic reality of Broadway, perhaps the final lead contracts were signed late.
That makes sense.
Or maybe an actor was swapped at the last minute, causing a delay in the official press release that editors need to cite.
It creates this funny, almost ghostly effect on the page right before opening night. It's like the skyscraper is finished, but we don't know who has the keys to the penthouse.
Exactly. But while the lead actors might be a mystery on this specific page right now, there is one thing that is absolutely not a mystery.
Oh.
If you scroll down to the very end of the Act Two track list, past all the new Mike Stoller music, sitting right there at the Sonelli is the song
Wind Beneath My Wings.
Yep.
Written by Jeff Silbar and Larry Henley, immortalized by Bette Midler in the 1988 film, and basically legally mandated to make everyone over the age of 30 instantly start crying.
Oh, without fail.
But here's my major question about this. How do you actually pull that off, tonally?
It's a great question.
Because we just spent all this time talking about how Mike Stoller came in and completely rewrote the DNA of the Schnitz with this mid-century rhythm and blues bespoke musical language. How do you suddenly shoehorn a mega hit 1980s synth pop ballad into that ecosystem without it feeling like a karaoke break?
Well, what's fascinating here is the massive tension between creating a cohesive new piece of art and satisfying raw audience expectation. Because you are entirely right. Musically, an 80s pop ballad is a complete alien invasion into a Mike Stoller score.
But you literally cannot put on a show called Beaches and not sing it. The audience would riot in the lobby.
Oh, they would.
They would demand their money back.
Precisely. The creative team brought in Stoller to write a completely original score because they wanted a fresh musical vocabulary for the narrative, right?
Right.
But Wind Beneath My Wings is so culturally synonymous with the property of Beaches that its inclusion wasn't an artistic choice, it was an architectural mandate. A stage adaptation of this story practically demands that specific Grammy-winning song.
I mean, think about the sheer terror of being the actress stepping into C's shoes for that moment.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
The audience is essentially sitting there for 2 hours with their arms crossed, just waiting for you to deliver the Bette Midler moment.
It is a vital piece of emotional architecture. After 2.5 hours of watching these characters endure decades of life's trials, the audience isn't just watching the catharsis, they're expecting to participate in it.
Right.
That song is the trigger for the emotional release the audience paid a lot of money to feel. It's strategically placed at the very end of Act Two for maximum impact. And honestly, Charlie Rosen likely had to completely reorchestrate it to bridge the gap between Stoller's sound and the 80s pop sound.
Smoothing out the edges so it feels earned rather than pasted on.
Exactly.
It's the ultimate payoff. Wow. When you step back and look at the whole timeline of this Wikipedia page, it really is staggering.
It is.
From the first spark of the world premieres in Virginia in 2014, riding high into Chicago in 2015, then the tragic loss of Tom Thomas bringing everything to a grinding 10-year halt, the delicate ecosystem just shattering, to the incredible resurrection in Calgary in 2024 with a brand new engine from Mike Stoller, all the way to tomorrow night when the house lights finally go down at the Majestic Theater on Broadway.
12 years. It is a profound testament to the sheer endurance required to bring a creative vision to life.
And I think that's the real takeaway here. A stalled project isn't necessarily a dead project.
No, not at all.
Sometimes a long winter is required before the spring can happen. If you are sitting on a passion project that feels frozen, or you hit a massive roadblock that feels like it shattered your own creative ecosystem, remember that even multi-million dollar Broadway shows sometimes have to sit in the dark for a decade to find their final form.
So true.
Stay the course, keep the blueprint safe, because eventually the curtain does go up.
But it does leave us with one final provocative question to ponder about this 12-year journey.
Okay, what is it?
Well, we talked about replacing the engine, swapping out the music, revising the book, grieving a co-creator, and changing the cast multiple times. it brings up the classic Ship of Theseus paradox.
Oh, wow.
When a piece of art undergoes a decade of rewrites, a completely different composer, and multiple iterations of actors, is it still the exact same show that was conceived back in 2014?
That's a great point.
Or does the trauma, the waiting, and the sheer passage of time actually weave itself into the DNA of the story, fundamentally changing what the audience sees on stage tomorrow night?
That is definitely something to think about next time you walk into a theater and see a show that feels completely effortless. Because behind that smooth magic trick, there is usually a beautifully complex construction project that survived against all odds.